Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Now, single payer is something we talked about a lot on this program over the years, especially when the debates were taking place or not taking place on that particular issue in the United States Congress. It's come up many times, and also we invited folks here from Vermont. We talked about how they were voting for their single payer system in Vermont, which will come up during the course of this conversation. And why is it coming up again? Well, because there's a man in town. That's a man who's come to town. His name is Dr. Gerald Friedman. Jerry Friedman is professor of economics at UMass and Amherst. And he is coming down to talk about the possibility of a Maryland Health Security Act, going to the state legislature to talk to folks today about this idea. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at the Diocesan Center, the Episcopal Cathedral of the Incarnation, which is right on the corner of Parkway and Charles Street here in Baltimore, Maryland. More information for that is at 410-235-3504. He's in our studio right now. And Jerry, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you slept down from Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Tell us why. What? This is clearly it's not on the agenda for this legislative session, but this the Maryland Health Security Act. So what are you? Who are you talking to on the Hill, and why?
Well, I'm talking to Delegate Homan. I think his name is Chair of the House Committee. We'll be doing that later this afternoon. I know it's not likely to happen this year, but the way things are going, the healthcare system in the United States is breaking down. Health is swallowing the economy. You may remember last year, this Bowles-Simpson people
Pardon me.
did this big scare everybody report about the deficits.
Right.
Well, if you go into their numbers, they have numbers for healthcare spending, and by their projection, which is actually the Congressional Budget Office, by 2052, healthcare spending will equal the gross domestic product.
By 2052.
Yes, yes. The joke is, and economists aren't usually very funny, but the Congressional Budget Office kind
of like
funny in this case.
Look like you could be funny if you wanted to. Go ahead.
Well, I just lay it straight, and if it's funny, then that's, you know. The Congressional Budget Office numbers go for another 25 years, which leads to the question of what are we living on, you know, and how is it that healthcare is greater than the whole economy for 25 years going on. So I will let them figure that one out. But for us, the issue is, I mean, healthcare is already about $8,000 per person in the United States. Maryland is about $9,000 per person. A family of four, you're talking about $32,000, $36,000. Uh-huh. You know, this is already a huge economic burden. And most of this burden comes, or at least a big chunk of it, maybe about half of it comes, because of our for-profit system. Healthcare in the United States is designed to make profits, not to provide care. And it's very good at making profits. The five largest health insurers last year, year before last, 2009, profits of $12 billion. The CEOs of those companies, total compensation came to $72 million for these five people. You know, this is a lot of money. We're spending a lot of money, about 17%, $1.06 of the U.S. economy already is healthcare, three times what we spend on the military. I think we spend too much on the military also.
That's another question.
That's another story. And for that, you know, we spend about close to twice what other countries spend. And we have 49th in infant mortality in the world, 50th in life expectancy. There are 49 countries that have longer life expectancy than the United States, 48 countries that have lower infant mortality rates than we do. We get health care in terms of looking at life expectancy. Our life expectancy is comparable to Portugal, a very nice country. I like to visit there. But they're poor compared to us, and they spend about one-third what we spend on health care. So I'd say we should either have life expectancy comparable to Scandinavia or Germany, or, which would be several years longer than we have, or we should get two-thirds of our money back. If we're going to only live as long as the Portuguese, then I want like $5,000 back for everybody. That Maryland Health Security Act, by the way, won't give you $5,000 back.
It won't.
But it will.
So, yeah, so what's going to happen? The argument for single payer.
Yeah.
Obviously, is very strong, and one that when President Barack Obama was running for president, he said it was going to be on the table, and it wasn't on the table when we got to these discussions. Mm-hmm. And industry really controls these discussions, right?
At least has a veto. You know, there are things in the president's law that are good, that the industry really dislikes.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those are interesting. For example, there was a bit of an internet scare going around because somebody pointed out that as of January 2013, companies, private health insurers, under the Patient Protection, Care Act, will be required to have a medical loss ratio of at least 85%, meaning, think about this. What they call medical loss is what we call providing health care. Medical loss is a percentage of the premiums that are spent providing, actually paying for care for people. And the law requires that this be at least 85%, meaning the law accepts that 15% of your premium dollars will go to administrative waste, profit, advertising, or harassment, which is a lot of what they do, which we'll come back to. And this guy in the Wall Street Journal was warning that, oh, my God, if this happens, mm-hmm. if they require 85%, then a lot of health insurers are going to go out of business. Mind you, traditional Medicare has a medical loss ratio of 98%. They have 2% of their money spent processing checks, checking for fraud, et cetera.
The rest going to providers.
The rest goes to pay for providers, pay for care.
Right.
In Canada, a year ago, I was testifying at a committee at the Massachusetts legislature on a single payer.
Trying to get one passed there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, is also going to – I think this is going to happen because we can't afford to maintain the current system forever. And single payer is really the only option, but it's not going to be for a while probably. I said that I was quoting an old statistic that in the early 1990s, Massachusetts General Hospital had 240 people in its billing operations, while Toronto General had two, with single payer in Toronto.
Toronto General was a big hospital.
A big hospital. Almost exactly the same number of doctors and patients, but two people in its billing compared to 240. And I said that was the 1990s, so it may be a little bit off.
Right.
Somebody came up to me and said that she works in Mass General, and she knows these numbers. There are 460 people in billing now.
And how many now at Toronto General?
I don't know, but probably still two.
Or maybe they might have four or five.
Yeah, maybe they moved up a little bit. Yeah.
So to say what? I mean, because when you go to a doctor's office today, any physician's office, you see the majority of people working in the office are working behind this rectangular place behind three or four, a dozen people working, filing claims, doing whatever they do.
Billing and it's called BIR, billing and insurance related expenses.
Right.
And about a third a third of physician activity, money is devoted to that.
One of the things we talk about a lot, and I want to get back to Maryland because that's what you're here to talk about, what you're going to do here in Maryland, what this Maryland Health Security Act, Security Act could do.
Yeah.
If passed, but the people also argue that that means you're talking about all those physicians' offices or all those hospitals. These are working class men and women who are going to lose their jobs.
Oh yes,
right?
Yes, but they will get other jobs.
This economy? What do you mean?
Maryland Health Security Act is a job creator.
How so?
In two ways. First, by expanding coverage to the 15% who are currently uninsured in Maryland, and there'll be increased utilization because so many people have inadequate insurance. And by doing away with copays, we will be increasing the demand for medical services. Those people who are currently doing billing and insurance activities in doctor's offices, there's money in the bill, actually, for this. They will be retrained as physician's assistants. Doctors will still need scheduling. They'll just need more scheduling. There'll be more demand for medical work, real medical work, helping people, not harassing them, which is what a lot of the insurance activities are, which we should come back to. But the second thing is This law, the Maryland Health Security Act, will be funded with a payroll tax that is lower than what companies are now paying for health care.
Describe more what that means. What do you mean by that?
Currently,
how does that work? Maryland
businesses pay about 11% of their payroll for health insurance.
Right.
The law will be funded with a payroll tax that is lower than that. It will be a dollar savings for companies, which will make Maryland companies more competitive. Plus, Maryland employers will not have to be going around dealing with insurance. I have friends who are small businessmen in Massachusetts, and I'm sure it's similar here. And a lot of the stress of their work, as well as a lot of their time and energy, is spent negotiating around the health insurance system. There'll be none of that. You know, it will be just payroll tax. You just send it in, and you're done. Issues will be between the physician and the worker, not the employer. The employer won't have to deal with it, and the employer will be spending less. And that will translate into better business opportunities for Maryland employers. They'll be able to compete better with employers in Delaware and Massachusetts. You know, Maryland will be a better place to do business, and that will create jobs. I estimate there'll be actually a net gain of 70,000 jobs in Maryland coming out of this, not even counting the stress and the happiness that will happen because people won't have to worry so much about health insurance.
Well, again, folks, we're talking about Jerry Friedman. Gerald Friedman is professor of economics at UMass, University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and he is here in Maryland today to talk with folks in the state legislature about some people want to like to push, but not be in this session, but the idea of a Maryland Health Security Act to create a single-payer system in the state of Maryland. Tomorrow night at 6:30,
yep.
On Tuesday night, he will be at the Episcopal Cathedral at the corner of University and Charles, speaking there with the physicians for National Health – physicians for –
National Health Plan.
Yeah, thank you.
Maryland.
Physician for National Health Plan. Thank you. And he'll be there speaking, meeting there, and have this conversation there as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with Dr. Gerald Friedman, who's the chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He is here to talk about the Maryland Health Security Act, Senate Bill 206, that they are pushing in Annapolis. Certain people in the state are pushing to create a single-payer health care system. He'll also be speaking tomorrow night at the Episcopal Cathedral over at the University Parkway and Charles Street at 6:30. You can call 410-235-3504 for more information. Stuff I've been reading about Vermont's single-payer health care system.
Mm-hmm.
Not system, but the bill that was passed.
Yeah.
That won't go into effect for at least till 2017.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Vermont's a very small state, 600,000 people.
Yeah.
That some argue that it is – that while this is an interesting political tactic to bring a discussion of single-payer health care to the state level, it's really not realistic to do on a state level. You really can't transform a system statewide. That it has to be a national system, that this is more of kind of a political push than it is reality of changing our healthcare system state by state.
It would be better if it was done on a national level. On the other hand, there are advantages because then you would just be able to do away with all billing operations. You know, it would be very simple. As it is, if Maryland adopted a single payer, they'd still have to work out ways to bill out-of-state people. So they'd still have to – we wouldn't be able to capture all the economies – all the administrative economies that we'd be able to get on with the national system if it's done only on the state level. That said, there's also a big advantage doing it on a state level because the first states that do it will be the states that will capture at least a large part of the economies, and they will get the economic advantage compared to other states. If everybody in the country did it, then Maryland would not gain anything over Virginia. But if you do it first – until Virginia comes around, you'll be the state that's getting the lower-cost business opportunities.
Well, I mean, can it be done? I mean, one of the things I've been reading here this morning, thinking about you coming over, I come back to talking about the heart of what you're proposing for the state of Maryland, that the way I was reading it is that this system is really not permitted under the Affordable Care Act.
There'd have to be waivers from the
And one doesn't know who, and so yeah. one doesn't know who's going to be president then, or right. who'll be right. governor here, or who'll be governor in Massachusetts. I mean, Vermont.
Yeah.
So I mean, this is a. That's why I'm raising the issue.
Actually, I think Peter Shumlin in Vermont will be reelected. He's very popular, partly because of the single payer. But yes, it would require waivers because Medicaid would be folded into the single payer system.
Right.
The way I wrote this, Medicare will be folded into the single payer system. The federal government would be making payments to the Maryland Health Security Trust, not directly paying providers, mm-hmm. as is done now. Now, to be sure, there would be savings for the federal government in this. The federal government would be able to capture not so much for Medicare, which is a very efficient program, but Medicaid is a very inefficient program in terms of administrative costs because there's all this checking of people's eligibility. All this,
right. You know. Are you really poor?
Right.
Are you poor enough to get Medicaid?
Yes. And or should you be under Medicare, or should you be on, all that. A lot of those administrative costs would be saved, and the federal government would capture some of those savings because they pay for about half the cost of Medicaid right now. The federal government would be a major saver through its own health insurance system, which is a relatively efficient system given a health insurance system. It's more expensive to operate than a single-payer system would be, which would have better economies to scale and capture some of the administrative savings that go from – the biggest area of administrative savings is not in the health insurers, although that's very large, billions of dollars, but it's actually in providers' offices. It's those people doing billing and insurance-related activities. Tracking down which insurance plan are you on? What does that particular plan cover? You know, sending out different bills here. I hurt my elbow last summer. I had physical therapy. We get bombarded with these bills, explanations of benefits, and then more bills. And anybody who's dealt with the insurance system knows this. So the federal government is spending a lot of money compensating providers for those costs, and which is costs that are built into the price the providers charge, as well as for administering its own system. The federal government would get savings there. So it's not impossible that the federal government would grant these waivers. It would certainly save it money. So that doesn't mean it will do it. But, and as I said, doing it on the state level gives you immediate advantages. Health insurance is becoming – it's already a major burden on Maryland employers. But think about it. If we continue the way we're going, health care costs rising at about 8% a year, double the rate of income growth. The burden on Maryland employers will grow and grow and grow, which means the benefit to Maryland employers from shifting to a single payer system now will become bigger and bigger and bigger over time.
And Jerry, let's talk about what's – I mean, clearly – look, the chance of this getting to the Senate floor in Maryland this year are probably none. Notwithstanding, mm-hmm. let's talk about the feasibility of this for the state of Maryland. I mean, and how it would really work. I mean, I heard you talk about that there are a lot of people in the state, I think, who support the idea of a single payer system, mm-hmm. And would like a more simple system to get their health care so everybody's covered. This is also a state that. Is awash in healthcare systems,
yeah.
from Hopkins to Maryland. NIH is just down the road. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. – yeah. it is one of healthcare central yeah. the United States of America, along with Minneapolis and a couple other places. Mm-hmm. So the rising costs, a lot of that is – it goes beyond just insurance companies. It goes to the cost of what hospitals charge and why they charge. It goes to the equipment people buy. It goes to many other things. It's not just insurance companies that make the skyrocketing.
Right. Now, if you take countries that belong to the club of the rich, so to speak, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, healthcare costs have risen in all of those countries.
Right.
Not just in the United States.
Right.
The United States stands out in three ways. First, we are the only country with a significant private component to our healthcare spending. About half of our healthcare spending is private. In other countries, there's very little private insurance. Canada has its Medicare system, just like we do, except it covers everybody. Second, every other country, go back to 1971, in 1971, most countries were spending about the same amount on healthcare. The United States was 7.1% of gross domestic product. Canada was 7.0. Since then, healthcare spending has gone up much faster in the United States than these other countries. Canada's healthcare spending has risen about 6% a year. Ours has gone up by 8% a year. Over time, that becomes a huge difference. Canada is now spending about 10% of its gross domestic product on healthcare. We're spending 17%. That difference, that 7 percentage point difference, comes to about $3,000, $4,000 per person. So that's the second difference. Our costs have risen much faster than everybody else. The third is everybody else has been getting much better health care. Our life expectancy has gone up. I mean, the better technology. My mother-in-law is 88. You know, people are living longer and they're living healthier. Better nutrition, better health care, better technology, all these things contribute. That's true everywhere. All these other countries are getting better health care faster than we are. Life expectancy has gone up 5 years in the United States, 6.5 years in Canada, 7 years in France, 8 years in Germany. We used to be about the healthiest. We used to be the tallest people in the world. Now we're shorter than most people from the rich countries, and we don't live as long, even though we're spending tons more. So the efficiency of our healthcare dollars is appalling. And a big part of that is administrative costs. Comparing Canada and the United States since 1971, 70% of the excess growth in our healthcare spending is due to the excess growth of administrative costs in our system. Everybody's buying MRIs. Everybody's getting, all the fancy technology. Everybody's training their doctors more, and that costs money. Everybody's having more physical therapy. As the populations age, you need more drugs. You need all this stuff. But it's only in the United States that we have this huge growing burden of administrative costs. And it's not just costs. It's also degrading, insulting.
What's degrading and insulting?
I've talked to, I have friends who are psychotherapists, doctors. They all tell me the same sorts of stories. I get on the phone to argue with some snotty-nosed such-and-such in Omaha, Nebraska, who's telling me that my patients don't need this, or they don't need that, or I should do this. The insurance companies practice medicine without a license by telling providers what to do. And for the individuals, I don't know if this is true anymore, but in Maryland, 10 years ago, there was an audit of some of the larger health insurers. This is secondhand, but it's a reliable source that's telling me about this. And they found that about 20% of the bills, clean bills, bills without any problem, were being rejected automatically. The health insurer was rejecting them on the grounds that, they hold on to the money longer. Maybe you don't bother resubmitting. You get this bill back, and the insurance company told you that you're not eligible. It's like, okay, I thought I was. Sorry to bother you. So you just pay it yourself. It's win-win-win for the insurer. That's illegal, of course.
Right.
And those insurers had penalties. But I that's the kind of practice that I think still goes on.
One of the things that people talk about that's happening in Vermont is that, besides what I mentioned earlier, is that because there's this huge waiting time because of the Affordable Care Act and other issues, which will happen here in Maryland as well, that there's a huge push by the insurance companies, because they have all this time and money to fight it, even if it did pass, let's say in the state of Maryland, to back it up. And that's a real issue. That's one of the, I mean, that...
Oh, the insurance industry spent $100 million plus fighting the president's proposals. In Massachusetts a couple of years ago, we had a statewide referendum on single payer, a recommendation, non-binding. The last 2 weeks, the insurance companies dumped like $12 million in the state on advertising. And, you know, they pulled out a victory for them instead of, you know, turned a 60% yes vote down to a 45% yes vote. The insurance company lobbies have huge resources. Now think about it. Why are they willing to spend so much money fighting single payer? It's because they are making so much profit on the existing system. You know, five companies, $12 billion.
Well, single payer would put them out of business.
And single payer would right? They'd lose those profits. They'd have to do something useful. No,
they would lose their business.
Yeah, they would lose their health insurance business. Absolutely. They would have to go back to selling homeowners. Or, you know, I don't know. Maybe they have to get retrained as doctor's assistants.
I mean, one of the people, some of the groups in Vermont now that are really kind of worrying about this are physicians and hospitals, because their reimbursements will be significantly lower under a single payer system than they would be under this present insurance system.
Because they wouldn't have the costs that they have now for administration. So they wouldn't need as much money. The doctors would end up, actually, under the plan that we have, one of the elements that I put into it is we save about 24% of the medical dollar by reducing administrative costs and by reducing some of the monopoly profits in the drug industry.
So how would the system work in Maryland? What would you be proposing for the state of Maryland to consider under this Maryland Health System Trust?
You go to the doctor. You show your card. They swipe your card. A bill goes to the Maryland Health Security Trust, and the doctor gets paid.
No out-of-pocket at all?
No out-of-pocket. No copay.
How do you pay for that?
Through taxes.
Taxing what?
Instead of paying health insurance premiums, businesses would send a check for 10% of their payroll to the Maryland Health Security Trust. It's less than they're paying now for health insurance, and there'd also be a 12% tax on so-called unearned income.
That's the tough one. You're talking about, as you write in your piece, capital gains, profits, rents, dividends, and interest.
Yes. above $500 per person per household. So a household of four, if you have up to $2,000. So this isn't going to affect the $5 a month you get on interest on your checking account or whatever. Most of the burden of the unearned income tax would be borne by people in the wealthiest 5%, really the wealthiest 1%. Everybody else, everybody below the top 95 percentile will be doing better financially under the system than under the current system. The current system basically has a flat fixed tax on everybody. What you pay for your health insurance premiums, what you're paying for the copays and deductibles and all that, that's basically a fixed amount for everybody. Because you get sick, you get sick. You know, the rich get a little more health care than the poor, but not that much difference. Basically, everybody gets health care. Everybody's paying this fixed amount. Switching to this, the Maryland Health Security Trust, what you pay will be proportional to your income, your ability to pay. Those who have more ability, those who have higher incomes, those who have higher wages and salaries, those who have income from dividends and interest and capital gains, they'll pay a lot more. So the bottom part of the population, by which I mean the bottom 80%, even up to the bottom 95%, they will do better under this. Even the wealthiest, they'll be paying more, but they will have the security of knowing that they have health care. Everybody has health care.
How would this affect or would not affect the bottom line of the budget of the state of Maryland?
Maryland would make $1 billion on it. The taxes that I devised would generate $1 billion more. I've put that in as margin in case I make mistakes. Also, there's another element here that I'm not including.
Yeah.
Starting, because I did this for 2013. Starting in 2014, Maryland will be getting $3 billion through the president's health care law. So that would allow the tax rates and the payroll tax and the tax on unearned income rate to be lower. Another piece of this that I didn't put in is that this will be an economic gain for Maryland. Maryland will get, I estimate, about 70,000 new jobs. That will generate more tax revenue, which will add to the state's bottom line. Also, one other piece here. The state and localities pay more for health insurance than do private employers. That's because a higher proportion of their employees are covered, and a higher proportion of their covered employees take up the health insurance.
So that would save the public sector.
The public sector would get bigger savings than the private sector.
Jeffrey, this has been interesting. As this thing goes on, we look forward to talking with you more. This has been a great piece you wrote. We're going to actually put on our website, Financing the Maryland Health Security Act. It will be a PDF on our website. You can check that out at sinoshow.org. Jay Friedman, who is the chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, is here to talk to people in the state Senate today and the House about why we need a single payer, how it can happen. It's Maryland Health Security Act, SB 206. And tomorrow night, he will be speaking at the Episcopal Cathedral of the Incarnation at the Diocesan Center, which is right in the corner of University of Parkway and Charles Street. And the number for information is 410-235-3504. And Jerry, thank you so much. Good to have you in studio.
Thank you for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.